You can meet and hear Bill Barr, Albert Mohler, Chris Roseborough, Brian Wolfmiller, Joel Bierman, and Will Whedon at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 24th and Saturday, June 25th in Chicago. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th at Concordia University, Chicago. We talk a lot about critical race theory. We have a pretty general idea about what we're talking about there, but it's really a narrow category of a larger ideology, which is critical social justice. Critical social justice is as dangerous as critical race theory because it includes a lot of other bad ideas, including those in critical race theory. And of course, all of this, the epicenter for all of this, is our schools, isn't it? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday, February the 10th, we're going to talk about critical social justice in public schools. Dr. Scott Yenner joins us. He's professor of political science at Boise State University, Washington Fellow at the Claremont Institute's Center for the American Way of Life. He's author of the book, The Recovery of Family Life, Exposing the Limits of Modern Ideologies, and co-author of a new study titled Critical Social Justice in Idaho K-12 Education. Dr. Yenner, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
What do you make of the response of critical justice proponents to the recent outpouring of parental concerns?
I think it really does point to a clash of civilizational views. I think that the Virginia governor's race that happened a few months ago really revealed this. The Democratic candidate, Terry McAuliffe, was known to have said something like this: I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach, suggesting that it was really the public job to figure out everything about a child's psychological, social, educational makeup over the course of time. And that was rejected by the voters of Virginia because there was a view that parents really should be in charge of or have a significant say in the education of their kids. So I think that it's a clash. It's a big, big-time clash between those who have a parent-centered view of education and those who have a society-centered view of education.
What is critical social justice?
The big question. A lot of people call it critical race theory, but in our report, we call it critical social justice, and we do that because it has a broader, you know, application. Critical race theory limits itself to the question of race, and the critical social justice, we think, as a label, brings in all of the other things that fall under the rubric, things like the sexualization of children, the promotion of alternative gender identities, the idea that America is ableist and homophobic. So we use critical social justice. The attributes of critical social justice is that it has a kind of critique of America and other civilizations and a remedy. The critique is that there are secret structures of oppression that exist in political communities that are enforced silently, systematically by the dominant culture in order to get its way. So sometimes it is thought that those structures are racist, sometimes that they're sexist, other times that they're homophobic and other things. But that this can be remedied by changing the minds of people, by shaping them in a different way. So critical social justice tries to insult, break down, expose, and ultimately undermine the dominant culture so that a new liberated reality can be experienced by all the people in the in that political community, so it says. So the first stage of it is to be pretty anti-white, anti-male, anti-heterosexual, with the promise that maybe someday we'll all be liberated from these structures of oppression. And the, as I say, the same kind of analysis is applied to race, sex, orientation, and other things.
If you would take us through the lexicon of critical social justice, what kind of terms of art are we going to be looking for?
Yeah, when it comes to K-12 education, there are different terms of art than, say, policing or higher education. And the vehicles through which critical social justice is delivered kind of depend on whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about sex and other things. But we identified in our report 8 particular ways in which critical social justice makes its way into K-12 education. One of them is called culturally responsive teaching. Another is called social emotional learning. Another is called action civics. Another, equity. Restorative justice is another one. Whole child or student-centered education. Trauma-informed education. Queer theory. All of them share that same attribute of having that big-time diagnosis of the structures of oppression that exist in society. And all of them offer slightly different ways of breaking down those modes of oppression. So, for instance, one of the big and most important of these that you'll find in many K-12 schools is culturally responsive teaching. And what culturally responsive teaching does is it caters to the stereotypes associated with identity groups. It's a teaching method that's supposed to denigrate the dominant morality of a society and coerce students into modifying their behavior to conform with cultures that are more marginalized. An example of this would be something like a curriculum that exists, and the curriculum will be skeptical of finding the right answer to a math problem and encourage using math as an agent of social change. You know, and this goes through for all 8 of those particular applications of critical social justice. There are associated policies, teaching techniques, curriculum that are developed, clubs that'll be formed in order to promote that promised liberation in the future.
How has this ideology itself, how has it incorporated itself into our schools?
Yeah, and really, that's a 50-year project or 60-year project. This is really the last outgrowth of what, you know, when I was a very, you know, an infant in the early 70s was called multiculturalism. Multiculturalism was an attempt to stigmatize the dominant culture in order to accommodate the ways and the differences that marginalized groups apparently had. And multiculturalism has been integrating itself into our teaching, into our schools, into our schools of education, into our curriculum, really since the mid-70s. Slowly becoming the dominant ideology in schools of education. It defines how teachers are prepared. It's sewn in some ways into accreditation standards. So the cancer of critical social justice has been metastasizing for, you know, well over 50 years at this point. However, there was a kind of real push to make it a mandatory aspect of state education systems during the Obama administration. These standards, like social emotional learning, cultural responsive teaching, are to one degree or another sewn into what is called Common Core. And the Common Core, which was passed in the early 2010s, attaches federal funds to states adopting this core curriculum that has many of these attributes in it. And those attributes that weren't in it could be added later on by education bureaucrats at the federal level. So the strings that came with the money brought along critical social justice. And so it's very difficult for any state, Idaho, New York, you know, red, blue, to escape the influence of this critical social justice ideology, because it's almost a federal mandate, and every state or nearly every state has accepted the strings that come with federal money. So this stuff has been around for 50 years, but really it's accelerated in its influence. It's sewn its way into accreditation standards even more since 2010. And one more thing about that is that once it became mandatory to have this stuff, schools had to find ways of training, had to find curriculum. Many left-wing groups grew up around Common Core in order to provide the needs that that schools now had to promote critical social justice in whichever way they could. And so there's a real industry that has grown up around the money that has been attached to the federal funds. So school districts, you know, this is a mechanism whereby it works. School districts have to get teacher training. So the teacher training ends up being provided by these outside groups, or the curriculum ends up being provided by these outside groups in order to fulfill some of these mandates of Common Core.
So what is white shaming?
Well, that's the first aspect of critical social justice when it comes to race. It has a diagnosis and a remedy. The diagnosis is to stigmatize the dominant culture, and the remedy is to promise liberation after that dominant culture is torn down. The way we have seen it is accusations that people who like show up on time are acting white, as the Black History Museum had put it in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, is designed to like undermine the manners and mores that apparently are distinctive to whites. You know, so shaming the dominant culture, which just happens to be white in this area, is the first stage in the promised tearing down of that dominant culture so that liberation can occur for all groups. And shaming is just one aspect of that.
We're talking about critical social justice in public schools. Dr. Scott Yenner is our guest, professor of political science at Boise State University, co-author of a new study titled Critical Social Justice in Idaho K-12 Education. How does critical social justice sexualize our children? You can meet and hear Bill Barr, Albert Moeller, Chris Roseborough, Brian Wolfmiller, Joel Bierman, and Will Whedon at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 24th and Saturday, June 25th in Chicago. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th at Concordia University, Chicago.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Logia Journal, the Confessional Dogmatic Series. The works of Kurt Marquardt and many other resources are all brought to you by Luther Academy. Did you know that during this time of COVID-19, your purchases and donations help Luther Academy supply these same resources to pastors around the world? Please consider helping us with this important need through your prayers and financial support. Learn how you can help by visiting lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com.
Lutheran Talk.
We have an ecumenical responsibility to hold forth the Scriptures and to bear witness to grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone.
Lutheran Music.
Listen anytime, anywhere in 2020 with the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app. Download for iPhone, Android, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're discussing critical social justice in public schools with Dr. Scott Yenner, professor of political science at Boise State University. He's Washington Fellow at the Claremont Institute Center for the American Way of Life, author of the book The Recovery of Family Life, Exposing the Limits of Modern Ideologies, and co-author of a new study titled Critical Social Justice in Idaho K-12 Education. Dr. Yenner, how does critical social justice sexualize children?
It's a great question. It's a very important way in which critical race theory does not capture the entirety of critical social justice ideology. So, you know, one of the dominant ways in which, you know, society, I'll say, controls sexuality is males and females are different, or society might emphasize straights over homosexuals. So if we could get children earlier, if public schools could emphasize the sexual freedom and liberation of human beings earlier, that's the best way of escaping these dominant cultures that treat men and women differently or encourage men and women to be different from one another and encourage people apparently to be straight. So it's important to sexualize child's education in order for people to be genuinely liberated later on in life before the dominant culture can really influence their mind. So to bring this down into a kind of a brass tack situation, Christian morality teaches that sex should be safe for marriage. And part of its purpose, if it's not its most significant purpose, is the procreation of children. So that leads to certain kinds of sexual manners, like chastity before marriage, and perhaps opposition to abortion, and we've talked about perhaps even opposition to contraception. The sexualization of children would want children to be more sexually active more early and would promote the use of, contraception and promote the use of perhaps abortion, access to abortion, in order for people to be able to express themselves, children to be able to express themselves sexually earlier. It's the same analysis as the critical race theory and the white shaming, but it's just applied to traditional sexual morality.
What groups and institutions are promoting critical social justice in our schools?
Yeah, and this is one of the things that's very interesting because, obviously there are tons of interest groups that provide the curricular services and the trainings that school districts now need under the Common Core. So there's obviously an iron triangle between these interest groups and the education establishment and the law that Congress has passed. The Congress passed the law. It empowers those bureaucrats to put critical social justice tenets into the practices of school, things like the action civics and the social emotional learning. And then interest groups arise to provide them. And only, that initial stage of it is kicked off by elected officials. But once they've kicked it off, it kind of has a life of its own. And I think that's what has happened in many states. I don't think, for instance, when the Idaho legislature accepted Common Core and the money that comes along with it, they knew they were getting this whole loaf. They thought they were getting money in return for standards. And they didn't know what those standards were going to be. And those standards have evolved over the course of time to be what they are. The elected officials in many states didn't know what they were getting into when they signed up for the Common Core. But now they've become dependent on it for their funding schemes. And it's difficult for them to withdraw. So I think, they can be blamed for not withdrawing or not taking the problem as seriously as it might otherwise be taken. But, I think you can also say that in some ways, red state legislatures have been bamboozled by the way Common Core has evolved over the course of time. So the interest groups and the educrats are really, the accreditors, the schools of education that arise to provide teachers to meet the standards that Common Core has put forward, they are really the principal agents of this. But they're also beyond electoral. You can't touch them with electoral politics very easily. Difficult to see how you could unwind it except through very radical kinds of defunding.
Are there policy solutions to the dominance of critical social justice in education that you see?
Yeah, man, I don't think this stuff can be banned out of existence. I don't think you can very easily just fix this by saying, all right, no more action civics. I think the problem is that these eight techniques and the whole ideology are really sewn into the school system. It's like having brain cancer or something. It's inoperative if it's spread out over the brain, which means that, as I said kind of before, you have to have more fundamental reforms. And those reforms would have to involve loosening up accreditation standards. They could involve parental choice. They could involve really encouraging people who haven't been in schools of education to become teachers and making it easier for them to become teachers. I think it requires a real defense, a full-throated defense of homeschooling and other non-dominant culture methods of delivering education to kids. And so one of the conclusions is kind of sad and wasn't really what I expected when we undertook this study, is that the tentacles of this ideology are so broad and they reach into so many nooks and crannies of the education system that it's difficult to see a reform working. So then the principle then, it seems to me, beyond that, is that you have to assist willing parents to walk away from the education system and to look for alternatives that aren't as infused with this. It's not going to be easy to find them because most teachers have been prepared in schools that are informed by this. So you see it all the time that private schools have this problem too. So parents have to think very outside the mainstream when it comes to finding ways of providing alternative education for their kids. I would like to see the state assist that. I think that's the most important reform that could happen.
We're both members of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. Is this a great opportunity for Lutheran schools?
I think it is an opportunity, but we shouldn't overstate it. The opportunity lies in being distinctive from the American culture. And the question is, how much are Lutheran schools distinctive from the dominant American, you know, narrative that we have prevalent now? Do we get our teachers from schools that have the same accreditation standards as public schools? So I do think it's a great opportunity, especially for things like classical Christian Lutheran schools, to find a different way. But if Lutheran schools can partake in the same vices and problems that public schools and other private schools have, because they buy their curriculum from the same places on some subjects, they get their teachers from the same places, or our own teacher preparation schools are informed by the same ideology. So it's an opportunity, but with limits.
Dr. Scott Yenner is professor of political science at Boise State University. He's Washington Fellow at the Claremont Institute Center for the American Way of Life, author of the book, The Recovery of Family Life, Exposing the Limits of Modern Ideologies, and co-author of a new study titled Critical Social Justice in Idaho K-12 Education. You'll find a link to this study and to Dr. Yenner's book, The Recovery of Family Life, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives, issuesetc.org. Dr. Yenner, thank you very much.
All right. Well, I did my best.
Have you ever heard your pastor quote the Bible passage, without vision, the people perish? And then he goes on to talk about his vision for the congregation and seems to imply that if you don't have that vision, well, maybe you might be in danger of perishing. Well, vision is one of the buzzwords we're going to talk with on the other side of the break as we discuss evangelical buzzwords with Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.